Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to the January Arsenal Women Arsecast on arseblog.com, the best podcast dedicated to the Arsenal women's team, which we can say with absolute confidence because it is the only podcast dedicated solely to the Arsenal women's team. For those of you who follow Arsenal women will know that there has been quite a lot of controversy in the last week or so around players flying to Dubai over Christmas and New Year. For those of you that perhaps don't know, a few Arsenal players, a few Man City players, some Manchester United players, I think a Birmingham City player, a lot of England internationals flew to Dubai over the kind of Christmas break. Subsequently, several of them have come back with coronavirus. And the upshot is that most of the WSL games after the resumption of the Christmas break have been postponed due to coronavirus cases. And in Arsenal's case, we know three players went to Dubai. One of those has been named, two haven't. But one of them came back with coronavirus and subsequently mixed with some teammates who therefore had to self-isolate. And what this has kicked off is a real big controversy about, should players be doing that in the middle of a pandemic and then the knock-on effect of having games postponed. So there's been a lot of discussion over this and I think quite rare in women's football that people really round on women's footballers, but it's happened this week. And so with me to discuss not just really the incident, but the reaction to the incidents in particular and what it says about what we expect of women and female athletes is author of The Roar of the Lionesses and The Pride of the Lionesses, Dr. Carrie Dunn. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us again, your second time on the podcast.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
And before we crack on, I understand you're writing another book, is that right?
I am, yeah. It should be out before the Women's Euros, hopefully, if they're taking place in 2022. It's more about the history of the women's game. A lot of people ask whether I'd look into doing that. And this is more historical, but again, it's still telling people's stories as far as possible in their own words and going back as far as possible.
And I know that you interviewed someone quite recently who'd be of great interest to Arsenal fans in particular in this book.
Yeah, I had a lovely, lovely chat with Vic Akers just before Christmas. It took me a long time to actually pin him down. And then also we played phone tag for about 3 months. But yeah, we had a lovely long chat and just amazing to get his perspective on Arsenal women's glory years, I guess.
Yeah, and a real trailblazer, not just for, I mean, principally for Arsenal, but I think for the women's game in particular. So yeah, we look forward to reading that when it comes out. And maybe we'll even talk to you again ahead of publishing. But first off, let's kind of crack on then with the kind of with what's been labelled as Dubai Gate in the media of players, many of whom haven't really been identified, but lots of people know who they are, I think, kind of going to Dubai over the winter break. Last week, Tom Garry of The Telegraph broke a story that two other Arsenal players, it was already in the press that Katie McCabe had been. In fact, she put it on her social media. And then Tom Garry kind of broke the story that two other Arsenal players had been. And this has kind of opened a bit of a Pandora's box. And it's since become apparent that four Manchester City players went, some Manchester United players went, and some of them have caught coronavirus. Before we get into the reaction to the reaction, I think we really want to kind of put across that when we discuss the reaction, we're not saying people are wrong to feel indignant about it. So what was your initial reaction when these kind of reports came out and to the incident as a whole?
Do you know what? I was furious and I still am furious. I think it was a massively reckless, irresponsible thing to do. And I was in Casey Stoney's press conference on Friday evening, So it was a 6 o'clock press conference, and just as we all dialed in, the first thing they said to us was that their match against Everton had been postponed due to coronavirus cases in the Everton camp, which was weird because Willie Kirk had said to us earlier in the day that they didn't have any positive tests in the camp. So that was all very strange. And so I was in Casey's press conference, and she, to be fair, has been the only one who has really apologised for any of it. She said that she took responsibility for her players or her player or players who went to Dubai. She wouldn't be drawn on how many of her squad went. And she said that she'd take her responsibility. The buck stops with her, which is fair enough. And, you know, she's the manager, and yes, it is her job to kind of direct flack away from her players. I think it was the wrong decision, which obviously she has said in retrospect, but the players need to take some responsibility as well. I've seen people say, oh, you know, they're young. Like, well, a lot of these players are in their mid-20s, late-20s. They should know better. This is a decision that everyone had to deal with over Christmas. Are people going to travel, or are they going to stay at home and try and be as safe as possible? I appreciate that players had a two-week break over Christmas. Everyone wanted to see their families, but most of us decided not to due to the health and safety implications. And I think flying overseas in the middle of a pandemic, even though it might have been legally permitted, wasn't the wisest thing to do for anybody, no matter where you live in the country, no matter whether it was permitted in government guidelines. It wasn't the best choice to make.
Yeah, and we should say as well, there are kind of differing, because some of the players were in Tier 3, for example, so they were allowed to go, the Manchester City and Manchester United players. The Arsenal players were in Tier 4, so really they weren't. But Arsenal's public line is that they've accepted that these trips were made for business reasons, and that players' agents were out there. And, you know, I guess what Arsenal say publicly and what they think privately might be two different things. But I guess actually that we should acknowledge that's aroused a lot of anger as well. The fact that, you know, Arsenal, for example, are saying, well, actually it was for business reasons. What, you know, there's been a lot of clamour for apologies, and you referenced Casey Stoney's apology there. What's your take on, I guess, Arsenal and Manchester City are the big, you know, perpetrators here. What's your take on the public line there?
Yeah, I mean, I understand why they're doing it. I mean, if they did have business meetings out there, then yes, of course, they're allowed to kind of sit on the beach afterwards. That's fine. I mean, if that's what happened, then yes, that is permitted by the letter of the guidance. But I think it would have been so much better and so much more graceful had they just said the players were permitted to go, or they had permission to go if they had got permission to go. We realise in retrospect, it is not a good look. Fans will be annoyed by it. I'm really sorry. Perhaps we'd have made a different decision had we thought about it in more detail, which is what Casey said, essentially. It doesn't take much to do it. And obviously now Casey has a lot of kudos coming her way, because everyone has been so angry that no one has acknowledged some quite justifiable anger from fans. Because let's not forget, fans can't even go to matches at the moment, pretty much, across all of elite football. We're all sitting at home, not going anywhere, and doing our essential shopping, having our 1 hour a day exercise. And then when you see players posting their pictures on social media, it is quite infuriating. And I think also we know now that not all the players who were there were posting on social media. We know that they were trying to keep it as secret as possible, which also indicates to me that they knew that it wouldn't be received particularly well.
Yeah, and I think what's also made this quite interesting is that I feel like there's always this tension when you cover women's football between kind of covering it, you know, as a journalist, but also promoting at the same time. And sometimes there's not a comfortable overlap between those two things, because you can get sucked into being a bit of a cheerleader and a promoter, which you don't really get in men's football, because no one needs to do that. It's self-evident that it's very popular. It's not growing. In effect, but what's really struck me is the strength of the feeling and the reaction. There's been lots of pieces written this week, you know, really, I don't want to say turning on the players, but you know, that's been very, very critical. And I can't remember, I've seen it described as the first us and them incident in women's football. I'm not so sure about that because of maybe the Mark Sampson affair. And for people that don't know, Mark Sampson, the former England manager, was accused of making racist remarks to a few of his black players. And in the game after these allegations came out, England scored and the largely white players ran over to him to celebrate, which the optics of which I think were quite appalling, to be honest. So maybe there was that was a bit of an us and them moment as well. But I guess what before we really crack on to the kind of Twitter thread you put together that really inspired this podcast is there a reason really in women's football that fans and journalists alike should feel a closeness to the players that has perhaps led to some of this disappointment? Is that useful or worthwhile, or does that place an unreasonable expectation or kind of confer an ownership on the players that perhaps is a little bit unfair and maybe unhealthy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting observation to make. And I think that there is something in that. I think that fans and journalists alike do have a certain closeness to female players. But I think that's been deliberately cultivated. I think clubs have deliberately cultivated that. I think players have deliberately cultivated that. So you can't then turn around and criticise fans and journalists for being angry about feeling betrayed when you've just spent the previous however many seasons trying to get fans and journalists on your side in that way. Yeah, it's interesting, but also an absolute mess, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I wonder going forward whether, I think it would be really interesting to see whether any relationships become strained as a result. We will see. But the meat of the podcast, what I really want to get into was, I think it was on Friday, you put together quite an interesting Twitter thread on this and what it says, what the reaction says about our expectations of women and female athletes in particular. And obviously we're talking in a sporting context, but I think it goes much wider than that. And I guess I just want to give you the chance to perhaps expand on that thread that you put together and the ideas behind it.
Sure. So it was my tweets were in response to my friend Jen Offord, who presents part of the Standard Issue podcast. And she was saying that what she found most striking is that people seem surprised that women can behave badly too. And they kind of triggered kind of a lot of thoughts that kind of stem back to my own kind of PhD research, but also my journalism. So my PhD research was in the area of female fans of men's football. And pretty much before the turn of the millennium, so that's when I started doing my research in 2004. So before that, pretty much all the football research that had been done into fans was about hooliganism. It was about working class men. It was about working class men's use of their leisure time. And there was this kind of assumption that men who watch football would also be working in a factory during the week, which is actually why there's the traditional 3 o'clock kickoff. The expectation was that men would work in the factory on Saturday morning and then go into the game afterwards. And the only real mention of women in this kind of early academic research is the expectation that if you encourage more women to football, they would be there to encourage men to behave better. There's this kind of principle called the civilizing influence that a lot of researchers talked about. This idea that women are just morally better than men and them being there would encourage better behavior. And I was kind of thinking about this a little bit more. And again, this is kind of a weird connection, but I did my master's degree in English literature. And anyone who's read any kind of Dickens or Bronte or Hardy will be very familiar with this idea of the kind of neat, domestic, quiet, well-behaved female figure, what a lot of literary critics have called the angel in the house. It's kind of in opposition to kind of the evil, badly behaved whore, if you like. And this kind of binary opposition between men and women, I think, is kind of what we see in a lot of sports coverage now. And yeah, we still see it this week. We've seen journalists kind of talk about how they expect better from their female footballers because female footballers are such great role models. And there's this just kind of lack of nuance, this kind of failure to recognise that women are not morally good by the virtue of just being women. They are people, they are human, they behave just as badly or just as well as their male counterparts. And that absence of acknowledgement of that is still present in sports journalism. I found that so fascinating this week.
Yeah, and I studied literature too, and actually one of I can't remember who said it, but I remember coming across some criticism that essentially said the two biggest female characters in all of literary history are the Virgin Mary and the Whore of Babylon, and therefore like two completely polar extremes, and therefore, you know, women fit one of those roles. And another one of the things you said in that thread that really interested me was something about a deep-seated issue we have in society about the idea of women being competitive. And you know, like women being sportswomen as well, and you know, competitive people can be difficult, right? They can be difficult people to deal with because, generally speaking, they're not like most people, and that's difficult too, right? For us to reconcile that with female athletes.
Absolutely, and again, I talked about clubs and governing bodies deliberately trying to create a particular relationship with fans and journalists. And I think this kind of trying to play down competitiveness of female athletes is part of that. You'll remember 6 years ago now when the England squad came back from Canada with their bronze medal and that infamous FA tweet about they went out to Canada as daughters, partners and sisters, putting them very firmly in this kind of familial context. And there's this kind of real focus on saying that these top female athletes are in their kind of domestic context, that they're girls next door, that they're just like us, except just really good at sport. When obviously they're not just like us, they're genetic freaks, they're really good at sport. The rest of us are nowhere near as good at sport as these people. And we're nowhere near as driven as you have to be a top professional athlete. And there's this kind of long tradition of amateurism, Corinthianism in the women's game, which really hasn't caught up to the professionalisation of it. There's this still this idea that women play for the love of the game, not for money. And I think that is heavily tied up with what we've seen from the reaction this week. This idea we expect better from our women because they're not mercenaries like their male counterparts. And it's painful to watch this kind of unravel because people haven't realized, you know, the kind of these stereotypes that when women play football, they don't dive, they don't argue with the referee, you don't get kind of snide fouls off the ball. Obviously you do, but there's this really, really long held, deeply held stereotype that because women are amateur, they're morally good, they're in binary opposition to our mercenary professional male players, it doesn't happen. And yes, again, we're seeing this clash of ideas this week.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting as well, because last year, I remember there was a big reaction, for example, to Emma Mitchell going on loan from Arsenal to Spurs. And some of the that kind of brought up an interesting reaction, because you reference, you know, we have this idea that players aren't mercenaries. And so I'm not saying that Alex Greenwood is a mercenary, but she's played for Liverpool, Everton, Manchester City and Manchester United. And most players will go to Lyon if they get the offer because they know, you know, they don't have an affinity to Lyon. They know they'll get paid well and they'll win stuff. And that's absolutely like, why wouldn't you do that? And actually, you know, you look at the current Tottenham squad has six ex-Arsenal players in it. So, you know, there is, again, I'm not saying that they're mercenaries for doing that, but this does happen. You know, women athletes do go to where the next job is, where, you know, the best pay is and the best contract is. And you said something there that really struck with me as well about, you know, people say, oh, there's no diving, is there? And I kind of think, yeah, there is. There's loads. Mm-hmm. And one of the kind of theories I've had as well, and I want to get your view on this, is there's very few red cards in women's football, which when you watch it is shocking because there are so many bad tackles, mm-hmm. and which are usually given as yellow cards or barely even given as fouls. And quite often I sit there and I just think, what, that is clearly a red card. And my kind of pet theory about why more women players aren't sent off is A, that subconsciously some officials perhaps buy into that amateurism, that kind of, oh, okay, this actually isn't really like a Premier League game or anything. But mainly, I think it's because people think, well, like, I don't think a woman would do that on purpose. And there's a lot of discussion about refereeing standards. And I wonder what your take is on that.
Yeah, I think there's elements of both of those theories in what we see play out every week. I think also, again, because the women's game was professionalised so quickly, I think, and I'm not saying it was an explicit idea, but because players get fined for bookings and red cards, I think maybe there might have been something in officials kind of 10, 15 years ago. If I book this girl, she's going to get 50 quid taken out of her pay pack at the end of the week. And when you're paying to play still at the top level of women's football, that is still quite an impact. So I think maybe that was kind of, there were kind of dregs of that still. But yeah, I do think there is an overarching idea that a woman wouldn't mean a bad tackle because, you know, the girls, they wouldn't do that. What would they do that for? Only men are aggressive.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think also that there's something else that you kind of put in the thread, and I'll link it on the show notes, that really made me reflect as well on things that I not just have said in the past, but have said very recently when you talked about some of the reasons that people, particularly men, say that they like women's football. And I know I've said this many times that I see it as a kind of refreshing alternative to men's football, not just because of the, you know, I'm not really concerned about salaries and things like that. That's not something that really interests me. But I like, you know, I like the football and all of that. But there is like almost, I've described it before myself as like a non-league vibe, that you're closer to the players, that the crowds are a bit lower, so it feels a bit more like you belong and things like that. And actually, what we've seen with this incident is some of that has been pricked. And I guess, is that, and like you said, women's football does explicitly market itself along those lines. And I guess with this incident, do you think that is going forward still a useful way of marketing women's football? Or again, do you think that perhaps creates this kind of sense of unfairness, this angel in the house kind of vibe? Mm. Do you think that perhaps we should move away a little bit from that?
Yeah, I think there are a few strands there that I'd like to kind of respond to. So, I did some research at the World Cup in Canada, talking to England fans that had gone out to follow the England team. And I talked to them about why they started following women's football. And so often it was because it was in opposition to the evil, corrupt men's binary. It was accessible. Players were accessible. The clubs valued your custom. You could get to stand with your friends at the ground. You weren't being ripped off for ticket prices. It was somehow more real. It was kind of how men's football was in the good old days. So kind of harking back to this kind of mythical golden age of men's football, I guess, that everyone seems to think is a generation before now. I should also say it's not just a problem with women's football in England. It's all across the world. Women's football is kind of being treated as a kind of more nice, more real. These players are much more accessible alternative. I mean, you saw it during the US women's national team's court case for their equal pay. And some of the reaction to that is like, why would women want to get paid for doing what they should be honoured to do, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact that some of those court papers that got released had like players' home addresses in, the kind of failure to acknowledge that these are actually high profile women who might have legitimate concerns over security. And going forward, I honestly have no idea. I know that clubs will still want to try and market women's football as a financially viable, easily accessible alternative to going to a men's match if you can't afford the ticket prices. But yeah, I think you're right. I think this has gone some way to kind of blowing open the, not lie, but I guess again myths around women's football. The fact that it's a bit like when people are kind of going to stage door to visit actors to get autographs straight after a performance. You're not buying your ticket to make friends with players. Just because you can tweet them doesn't make them your friends. You're only buying a ticket to watch a football match. That's all your money entitles you to. And I think the intense capitalism of any kind of professional sport has become increasingly clear in the recent days.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
Yeah, and I think a lot of points people have made in the reaction, which I think are kind of good points, is obviously there's such a separate, like, women's football is so divided between the haves and have-nots, like even more than men's football. Just look at Arsenal's results this season. You can tell which clubs they play that have similar resources and which ones aren't, because they have a plus 30 goal difference. That tells you a lot. And you know, even like the second tier of women's football is semi-professional. Mm-hmm. And so there's you know, a lot of people been saying, you know, a lot of your direct colleagues and friends are key workers themselves, for example. But and so there really is a distinction between Arsenal, Manchester City, Chelsea, Manchester United and the rest. And these are a lot of the players who've kind of erred in going to Dubai. Do you sense that this is a beginning of a kind of a line in the sand moment, if not with the whole women's game, with those clubs?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think it's also important to kind of note that even when we say haves in women's football, we're not talking about massive amounts of money for the top players. I mean, they earn a good living, don't get me wrong, but we're still talking. I mean, part of the problem that we've had with the coronavirus cases in women's football is because so many of the players are in shared accommodation. They're not kind of in mansions with their own families. They're kind of sharing digs. And I saw an article in The Guardian this week, and it was saying, you know, Cristiano Ronaldo was in Dubai. Why is he getting nothing when some female players are getting loads? And you said, well, I don't think Cristiano Ronaldo's going to go back to some kind of little digs that he shares with four other of his first teammates and spreading a potential virus around with them. And I think this is the issue that people are overlooking. It's the lack of consideration of how it's going to impact on other people. And I mean, the haves and have not things we're also seeing in the FA Cup stuff that was, mm-hmm. you know, we're two rounds behind with the Women's FA Cup now. And one of the plans that's being mooted is to decide some of the outstanding ties on the toss of a coin. So you've got your tier three players, so the National League players who are being judged as non-elite, not being able to kick a ball, not being able to go to training, not being able to finish off their season at the moment or play their FA Cup ties. And then they're seeing their tier one and tier two counterparts kind of stretch the leash a little bit more than might be preferable. And I think they're quite rightly fairly angry. And I think You know, I've talked about this quite a lot before, the rapid growth of professional women's football in this country. I understand why it happened. I think perhaps it was too quick, because now we are seeing this gaping chasms between, as you said, the well-resourced clubs at the top of the WSL, the less well-resourced clubs at the bottom of WSL. And then we go into the Championship, which is semi-pro, which clubs can potentially turn professional if they get promoted, which clubs can't, which clubs from the National League would be able to step up to go semi-pro. It's really difficult. We have so few professional clubs in this country in women's football. Will they be able to stay professional if they go back to the Championship? You know, it's all up in the air, and I don't think there's a particularly strong strategy tying all this together, and we're starting to see some of the seams burst a little bit. We have such a shaky foundation for it.
And, you know, we've talked a lot about the kind of the fan reaction, the press reaction, but we should acknowledge there has been a reaction from inside the game as well. So you've got Emma Mitchell, an ex-Arsenal player, tweeting about perhaps preferential treatment for certain clubs who've got postponements this weekend, despite being perceived to have, you know, self-inflicted, you know, COVID cases. And then you've got someone like Gilly Flaherty, for example, very, very well known, very well respected figure within the game, has played with pretty much everyone who is everyone. And she's been tweeting, you know, these players should come out and apologise. And I mean, first of all, I guess, is the player reaction part of what we were talking about at all in terms of what we expect from female athletes? Like, can female athletes themselves kind of, I don't want to say fall victim to that, but you know what I mean? Kind of be a product of that thinking. And also, do you see, I guess, a line in the sand between the players inside the game?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly do think that female players can take on board some of these kind of binary stereotypes we've talked about. But also we have to kind of, we can think of it in typical professional sports terms. You expect a certain standard behaviour from your teammates, from your peers, from your counterparts. And when someone lets the side down, there's often a kind of self-policing almost. And I think that's what we're seeing here. We've got some high-profile players coming out and saying this is unacceptable and trying to maybe force some of the issue up into the open. And in terms of kind of an ongoing, perhaps, division between the players, I wouldn't be surprised. I don't see, unless the players obviously apologise vociferously in private, which might have happened, I don't know. If there hasn't been an apology, you can understand teammates being angry because it's their health being put at risk. And particularly when we know that players and squads are training within a bubble, we know that youth teams are being kept separate from first teams. When players are respecting rules that are very, very strict, that are possibly stricter than government guidelines, and then the government guidelines are flouted, you can understand why players would be angry. I would be angry. I am angry, and I'm not a player.
And with the kind of postponements, for example, so Arsenal and Manchester City got their games postponed. Birmingham City, for example, they asked for a postponement and didn't get it. They don't. I think they have one COVID case, but actually what they have is an injury crisis in a small squad. They didn't get their postponement. And There has been some accusations about the FA kind of kowtowing to the bigger clubs. There was an incident in October, I think, where Bristol City had five players self-isolating. They requested a postponement for a game against Man City. They didn't get it on the technicality that, A, they didn't actually have a positive test. They just had a player with symptoms who lived with four other players, and therefore they were responsible and, you know, kept them away. And effectively, they were punished for that. Mm. Do you think that that there's any truth to the idea that perhaps some of the bigger clubs are getting favourable treatment, or do you think this is just a really weird situation that leads to slight inconsistencies?
Well, I think it's a horrible situation. I think the FA having to make up rules almost on the hoof, and I think it has led to inconsistency and less than ideal decision-making. I mean, I feel terrible for the Bristol City squad, because that was ridiculous at the time. The fact that you had players doing the responsible thing as they've been requested to do, and then the squad, the team, the club suffers for it. I feel bad for Birmingham. I mean, what we're seeing with the coronavirus rule for match postponements, I hope I've got this correct. The idea is that if your squad number goes below 14 because of coronavirus, then you're entitled to ask for a postponement. And I think what other clubs are now rightly saying is, well, why is that only applicable to if coronavirus takes your squad below 14? Because we've seen plenty of incidents, you know, even at Arsenal when the bench has been fairly sparse. What about if you have, like Bristol City had, your self-isolating cases? If that takes your squad below 14, why doesn't that count? If you have one coronavirus case and then, you know, a dozen injuries like Birmingham seem to have had, why doesn't that count? It's an absolute mess. And, you know, I hate to use the word, it's become a cliche, but, you know, it's unprecedented times. It's difficult to come up with rules that work for everybody, but this has been such a strange week, a horrible week for everybody involved, you know, whether that's fans, players, journalists, clubs, the FA. I don't think anyone would have expected any of this. And yeah, it does look like some decision making has been slightly harsh on some clubs, and it is not an ideal situation.
I just want to finish to kind of really pick back up on, you know, this idea of what we expect of women's football, of women's footballers and athletes and things like that. And, you know, you referenced, you know, talking about how a lot of fans have kind of been attracted to the women's game as this kind of binary, I guess, opposite to the men's game. I know lots of people who say that, who say I fell out of love with men's football and I found something that I prefer at women's football. I've said that. Myself, and I mean, I guess it's nuanced, right? But do you think that that's the wrong way to think about women's football? Do you think there's some justification for feeling like that, or do you think that actually, even if well-meaning, it does come from a place of expecting less of women?
I don't think it's necessarily expecting less of women. I just think it's a different set of unhelpful expectations. And I think maybe there was some truth to a lot of these ideas kind of maybe 20 years ago. But I think with professional sport, which is essentially there to make money, I think it's just not necessarily viable any longer. I mean, is it going to be that people who are looking for this kind of ideal of football, where people are playing for love of it, are they going to go down a couple of tiers to watching tier three, tier four women's football? You know, that's there to watch. There are clubs there to support. Could it be that clubs now, with their player behaviour, are essentially biting the hand that's fed them through this 10-year growth of professionalisation? I don't know. We'll have to see. But yeah, it does feel like kind of a crunch time to me.
Yeah, I guess I was going to ask, do you think it was always inevitable that this like Corinthian idea would start to erode away? Or do you think that there was a way, was there a way of having our cake and eating it, of professionalising the game, starting to pay players what they deserve, but keeping that closeness? Do you think that's possible?
I think certainly the facade of it was going to, or probably still will, continue. I think these stereotypes are really, really hard to break. This expectation that women behave better. I mean, it's not just in sport. It's not just in football. It's in all of society. There are certain expectations. You know, the phrase boys will be boys. Boys are expected to behave in certain kind of chaotic, bad ways, and that women are expected to set a good example. You know, we see it in kind of child raising theories, the fact that we expect boys to be a certain kind of chaotic and rebellious and noisy and messy and dirty, where we expect girls not to. So these are deeply held ideas. It's not just in football. So I think probably these stereotypes will carry on, but I think people are starting to see through, perhaps it's slightly more opaque in football than it was this time last week.
Yeah, I think just as an aside, I'm going to use any excuse I can to throw in a bit of a Bjork analogy, my favourite musician. But there was an incident in the mid-90s where she attacked a reporter. And I remember... Like the fallout of that was, oh my God, like this female musician has attacked a reporter at an airport. Like she kind of went for this reporter. And yet, like when you look at how rock and roll behavior, should we call it, is reported amongst male rock stars, it's much like if Liam Gallagher does that, it's kind of, oh, Liam's.
Oh, Liam. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Just as a final question to bring this to a close, we touched on it earlier, but I'm quite interested in this idea, probably in quite a self-indulgent way, about the line between being, a fan of the women's game and a journalist. And this is something I've thought about a lot recently. And I know, for example, in the comments on Ask Blog News, sometimes people say to me, you're too pally with Joe Montemuro, and things like that. And it's the first time I've really been confronted with that kind of criticism. And it's made me think about, where does my being a fan and being like a reporter, I guess, where does that begin and end? And I've been thinking about that, looking at some of the coverage this week, because the truth is, most people that cover women's football do so because there's an interest there and they're fans first. Is there a distinction, or has there been a distinction between the journalist and fan reaction to this? And if not, should there be?
Again, there are a couple of threads there that are worth kind of interrogating a little bit more. I think we see this kind of difficulty of journalists being close, for want of a better word, to the subject of the thing they report about. We see that, again, across society. These are the people that you're seeing day in, day out. You have to talk to them day in, day out. You need to walk a very fine line between asking difficult questions that need to be asked and maintaining a decent relationship with them so that you can actually have something to write about. You see it in politics, you know, that's been kind of one of the overarching themes of the pandemic, hasn't it? The open press conferences and thinking, why are you asking that question like that? Why are you not following up? Why haven't you? You're too chummy with them. All those kind of criticisms. So there's that. From what I've seen this week, journalists, by and large, who concentrate mostly on the women's game, have been just as angry as any of the fans I have seen. They might have been slightly more measured about it. I think fan response has been kind of quite instinctive, and journalists have kind of taken the time to kind of think about how all the moving pieces have fitted together. They've had to ask clubs particular questions to find out, you know, who got permission, who didn't, all that kind of stuff. But I think by and large, journalists have been just as angry as fans. I mean, there are a couple of exceptions. Some journalists that I've spoken to have kind of been like, well, I don't really see that much wrong with it, but, you know, maybe they should apologise. But by and large, I think fans and journalists, and from what it seems like, a lot of players are pretty much united on this one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder if maybe going forward, whether, and I'm not necessarily saying they should, but again, like talking about line in the sand moments, does this create tension between, because I'm thinking of, like, should we say, the guilty parties, right? The players, like, they're seeing all of this, I'm certain. I know some of them are, and what kind of reaction does that produce? Does that begin to create a distance, or does that just create reflection, or, you know, does that just push these poles apart a little bit, and I guess whether maybe that's healthy?
I don't know, it's difficult to kind of predict what's going to happen, because I don't know who is seeing what from the reaction as well. It will be interesting to see how it pans out over the next week. I think if we get past this point next week and there's been no kind of forthcoming or apologies or statements from any of, as you say, the guilty parties, then we might have a greater problem. I think we've still got a little bit of a grace period here.
Yeah, definitely. And at time of recording, you know, it's Sunday. There's only one fixture today. Next weekend, hopefully, we'll have more fixtures. And that, because, like, the story isn't going to move on until some games are played, basically. So I think you're right that the next kind of week is very, important. in that respect, and we'll know a lot more this time next week. Anyway, Dr. Carrie Dunn, I've taken far too much of your time already. That was really fascinating, and I'm really grateful, because I wanted to do something on this, but I wanted to do something a bit different. And I think the angle of talking about, like, how, you know, what it says about what we expect, and perhaps going a bit meta and looking at the reactions, has been a really refreshing angle, and I feel like I've learned a lot from it. So thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Hopefully next time I can come on in slightly nicer circumstances.
Yeah, indeed. We've done two really heavy topics now the last couple of podcasts. Like last month we did, you know, representation of black women in the media, and that was very heavy. And again, I learned a lot from that. But yeah, perhaps next month we'll do something a bit lighter and maybe talk about actual football for a change. But nevertheless, thank you so much for your insights, Carrie. Really, really appreciated. We will be back with another episode in February. Don't know what that's going to be about yet. Hopefully something a bit lighter. But until then, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll speak to you very soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.